Hello, and welcome to see us talk about this topic and this event, which is called Girls Uncovered. My name's Bhakti Pumanantharan. I'm the host of this panel, and my publishing knowledge is nowhere near as great as these three women, so I'm going to introduce them now. Chrissy Neen is an author and a bookseller from up north in Brisbane. Her memoir, Affection, remains one of my favourite books ever. She's also written a book of erotic stories called Triptych and a non-erotic novel called Steeplechase, which came out last year. Chrissy's blog is called Furious Vaginas.
Thank you.
Leva Singleton-Norton is a writer and activist in the fields of disability and feminism. She has been program manager at Express Media, which is how I came to know her, and is a long-time comedy producer and writer for such illustrious outlets as SBS and The Big Issue. And Mary Masters is general manager of the Small Press Network and chair of the Emerging Writers Festival Board. Mary has a range of experience in publishing and marketing, and she also used to be managing editor at Hardy Grant Egmont. So thank you all for being with us. We don't have a designer on this panel. We tried to get a designer to be on this panel, a book cover designer, but it's a small field, and I think it was a big ask for us to try and get someone to be so critical of their industry. So I wanted to ask if there are any designers in the audience.
Uh-oh, someone's been talking.
I can understand if you don't want to job yourself in, but anyway, if there is one that we could, you know, throw to at some point, that would be crowdsourcing our content. Okay, first up, Chrissy Neen has put together a PowerPoint slide and she's going to take it away.
Hello. My main interest in this area is as a bookseller, although it does affect my work as a writer as well. I've been bookselling for 20 years now, and for the last 10 years of that, I've been an events coordinator. So I've seen a lot of book jackets and marketing kind of plans come across my way. And my worst thing, and the thing that I really hate most about being a bookseller, is the fact that everything is gendered. I've called my PowerPoint Gendering the Jacket, or Could You Wrap That for a Boy? Because that is the single most irritating comment that comes several times, many, many times a day, particularly at this time of year. Could you wrap that for a boy, as if a boy needs a particular type of wrapping and a girl needs another type of wrapping? Also, they say the boy book is for the boy, the girl book is for the girl, which really irritates me because I kind of think, well, you know, you're just assuming that the book that's got, you know, war or dinosaurs is going to be appropriate for a boy and not for a girl, which I think is a problem. So I'm going to start by dubbing in another fellow bookseller. He's dubbed himself in. This is John Page. John Page has a blog, and his a particular comment is still up on his blog that you can go and have a look at, but I'll read it to you now because it did make me think about the idea of book jackets and gender. John Page says, I completely failed the Australian Women's Writers Challenge this year. I did not read one book by an Australian woman in 2013. I didn't avoid books by Australian women, but nothing grabbed me. Nothing made me want to pick up a book and stay with it. I did try a few, but nothing by a female Australian writer appealed to my reading tastes or moods throughout the year. One of the reasons initiatives like the Australian Women Writers Challenge and the Stella Prize was started was because of the lack of review coverage and recognition by literary awards of books by Australian female writers. However, I think that while some books are marketed along gender lines, this problem will not go away. Marketing affects reviewers and prize judges just as much as it does readers. Not all books are marketed along gender lines, but there are many good books that a publisher will choose to aim at a specific gender, which does create a barrier towards readers of the non-targeted gender. Gendered marketing is most notably done through cover design. The cover is the first impression a book buyer has of a book, and while we shouldn't judge a book by its cover, it does have so much influence on the first opinion of a book. A book cover can communicate many things to a reader. It can signify genre, subject, tone, and can skew towards one gender or another. and stickers from women's magazines on the covers only exacerbate the problem. So that's a direct quote from John's blog, and John is from Pages and Pages in Sydney. And, you know, it's easy to kind of say, come on, John, you could have read a book by an Australian woman that year. There were lots to choose from in 2013 that were fantastic books. I know you didn't. But you actually do have a point in terms of the books that John likes are often, you know, big blockbuster, very male-targeted books. And so, therefore, the marketing of the books did affect him as a reader, and he is the first reader because he's a bookseller, and he then influences dozens and dozens of other readers. So if you're not kind of grabbing that particular bookseller into reading Australian women's books, then you're probably not going to get those Australian women's books into the hands of a whole bunch of people who would probably enjoy them. I've got a particular example there of one of my favourite books, which is Julius Winsome by Gerard Donovan. And the first jacket on the very far left is the first jacket that came out. And it appealed to me because I like books about guys who live on their own in a shed in the snow. Very specifically, any book about a guy who lives on his own in a shed going mad in the snow is a book for me. So I really liked that first jacket. And it's a fantastic book, and it's become one of my favourite books. But the second jacket was the next jacket it was released with, and it looks more like a crime novel, which the book is just not. And if it had come out with that jacket, I would not have picked it up, and I would not have hand-sold it to dozens of people. The third jacket, I'm going to say it looks like a YA novel, and this book is not at all a YA novel. So, you know, you can target a completely different audience. In fact, one designer, Peter Mendelssohn, said that on one level, just dust jackets are billboards. They're meant to lure in potential readers. For a certain contingent of the publishing industry, this means playing it safe. The path of least resistance when you're designing a jacket is to give that particular demographic exactly what they want. So, you know, if someone was a crime reader, they probably would have picked up Julius Winsome in the second version, not in the third version. So maybe the publishers were going, well, maybe it didn't sell in the first version, so let's see if we can sell it to crime readers because there's a murder in it. You know, it's hard to tell. Marketing works in really, really different ways. You have to find the readership for the book, and you have to appeal to that readership. It should discourage the reader from buying the wrong book. So if I pick up a book that's all about shopping, I'm really going to hate it because I hate shopping. So, you know, I want those books that have girls with shopping bags on it. I don't want to read it. Better kind of, like, warn me off. This particular series of images are warning people off Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in lots of different ways. As you can see, there's three different versions, and they all appeal to an incredibly different target market. I have to admit I'm the middle target market, which is the classics edition of this, but this is a book that also has lots of lives, so you can afford to play around with the targets. You can afford to have the kids edition, the classics edition, and the edition that appeals to people who are a little bit kind of bent and maybe on drugs. The next slide is actually about how gendered bookjacking works. This is a particular series of books by Anita Heiss that I happen to love. I love them not because of the shopping in it, because I really hate shopping books, and there's a lot of shopping in these books, but I love it because it's really subversive, because these are books that are about black, urban, Australian, Indigenous women who are you know, doing the sort of things that are in chick lit generally. You know, we tend to kind of market books about Aboriginal women in a particular way, and this is not the way we normally market them. So what I love about this marketing is it's going for young women who like chick lit books. The books are chick lit, but they're chocolate, she calls them, and they're really they're kind of sneaking in the Indigenous content, and they're full of kind of references to Indigenous art, to Indigenous women being just awesome and amazing, also Indigenous women liking the shopping and fucking stuff that is, you know, there in the chick lit book. So it's kind of great and subversive, and I've kind of listed a whole bunch of things. You know, there are books that should be intentionally targeted towards women. And they have kind of secret women's business in them. They'll be predominantly enjoyed by women. This one is about strong Indigenous women in an urban setting. And they also play to the marketing of other books. So this book has kind of identified that there's a whole bunch of books that have these kind of great lolly-coloured covers that are specially for, you know, for women to read, for young women to read and enjoy. And young women who maybe don't read a massive range of books but read this particular narrow cast books. So this book is really subversive and works in that way. This book is problematic in its second edition, I think, because Alice Munro is really, to me, Alice Munro's work feels much more like the first and hardcover jacket of this book than the second paperback jacket. The paperback jacket of this book would have turned me off if I did not know that Alice Munro was an award-winning, amazing literary fiction author. It would make me think that it's about a bunch of girls at the beach, which is not what I necessarily want to read about, and possibly not what's going to be across the radar of the people who are judging the prizes. So that's a fail. This one is interesting to me because we all know that the Rosie Project has sold a gazillion copies, and it's sold to both men and women, and it often appeals to both men and women. And we have a jacket that does not turn women off, has, you know, a bunch of flowers, which means there's a romance in it, but also has a guy on a bike, and it's quite strong letters, it's quite a strong visual statement, which is going to appeal to both men and women. And yet, in the US, that's what we get. Which I think is really going to mean that in the US, the guys are going to avoid this like the plague. Again, we have the bell jar, lots of strong, dark colours. And then, as opposed to that, enough said. This is a quote off the Stella Prize. Does everyone know about the Stella Prize? Yep. I thought we'd kind of... It was... invented to kind of counter the idea that that male books by men win more of the awards and get reviewed more often. So the Stella Prize says, in general, women have won the fiction division of the various state premiers literary awards about a third of the time, even though fiction is an area that women are associated with as writers. The statistics for non-fiction are even worse. This is my book, my first book. The first edition, which is the first book, jacket is the Australian first edition of my book, which is the larger format trade paperback, which I was quite happy with because it's referencing Anais Nin, it's referencing those classic Penguin sex books like Georges Bataille and Anais Nin, all those books that I love, and I thought that was, you know, I did ask them to down the pink a little bit, and they didn't quite down the pink, but they did a little bit. In America, they upped the pink a bit more. But then when it went into B format, we went for the pink flower. And I don't have much say... I don't have any say in my jackets, actually. And I did love The Flower. I think it's a beautiful book, and I think that it's a beautiful-looking book, but I also think it's a very gendered-targeted book. So I was glad that my book got a first run in a slightly less gendered book, because if it had come out in The Pink Flower... first, I think that it would have been read by young women, and that's it. And luckily, I picked up a whole bunch of guys to read it at an early stage. I think that the problem starts with kids' books. I've put Helicopter Man first because I have been told, I wasn't there at the time, but this is anecdotal, that Elizabeth Fensham, when she won the award for Helicopter Man, she got up and said, originally, my character for this book was a girl, and I realised that I would be alienating half my audience because, as we all know, boys don't read books about girls. So I changed it to a boy, which I think is, you know, valid, really valid, because that's what I hear from parents and that's what I hear from teachers when they come to buy books. When they're buying a book for a boy, they say, we don't want a book with a female protagonist. We want a book with a male protagonist because boys don't read books about girls. And I think this is where the problem starts. So I don't think that we can actually change the targeting of books to adults until we look at the targeting of books to kids. I've lined that up against a couple of Meg Rossoff books that do exactly the same thing. So they're books for young adults, but also the half-head girl book is definitely for girls. But Meg Rossoff is a very literary author, and the second jacket is probably more representative of her work. This is the kind of stuff that girls get. We get The Headless Woman, There are lots of trends in women's jackets. The Headless Woman, this particular set is put together by Philippa Gregory, by Gillian Audrey, and as booksellers we call it the Philippa Gregory, because the Headless Woman is always on the cover of Philippa Gregory books. And we kind of laugh every time we see a headless woman because we know that it's definitely targeted to girls only. We also have the half-head woman. And booksellers call that the Paulina Simons cover. And it's definitely got, you know, it's got a look. And so if you've got a book that's similar to Paulina Simons, which is going to be aimed at women, it's only a half-head. Or we've got the back, woman taken from behind, which, you know, has several meanings. But this particular jacket is also another trend in books for women. Someone else who was pissed off about this idea was Maureen Johnson, who was pissed off that her books got the girly treatment every time. And so she put a challenge out on Twitter and said, I wish that someone had done masculine covers for my books as well so that boys could read them. So a whole bunch of people did masculine and feminine covers for the same book. So Franny and Zooey, J.D. Salinger, got this treatment. William Golding, Lord of the Flies. Is that cute?
That one was
piggy.
My favourite. I love that one.
Freedom, which is another book that's come under fire because it's a domestic novel. It's basically a domestic novel that if it had been written by a woman, it certainly wouldn't have got the press that it got. And that's a great jacket for it there. On the Road, Jack Kerouac, it's a road novel. Alexi Sherman's Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. Go Indian. And this one, Throne of Glass by Sarah J. Maas, I probably would have picked it up if it had this jacket. Now I'm ending I'm ending this introduction with a quote from Lionel Shriver. She says, when my novels are packaged as exclusively for women, I'm not only cut off from a vital portion of my audience, but clearly labelled as an author the literary establishment is free to dismiss. By stereotyping my work's audience as self-involved and prissy, women-only packaging only insults my readers, who could all testify that trussing up my novels as sweet, girly and soft is like stuffing a Rottweiler in a dress. So we're here, I think, today to talk about Rottweilers and the dresses that we're putting them in.
Yes.
Back to Vachi.
I also wanted to say about Maureen Johnson, who was the woman that did the cover flip experiment on Twitter, that she gets emails from men every day saying, please just put a different cover on your book so I can read it on the train. She said she would honestly be hundreds of thousands of dollars richer if that happened. And that's an extraordinary thing, that it confuses me that publishers are not tuned into that. But before we go into the discussion, now we know why Chrissy is kind of engaged with this issue. I thought I'd give Mary and Leifa an opportunity to talk about why they're interested in this issue. So do you want to go first, Mary?
Sure. I'm maybe the odd one out on this panel in that I'm totally pro. I'm pro gender on covers. For me, it's as a publisher and as a marketer, it's about signposting for readers exactly what it is that you are delivering to them. You know, Chrissy talked about being a bookseller, and the bookseller is that first gatekeeper who you have to get past in order to get your book sold to, you know, readers. And yes, while John may overlook reading himself something that is dressed up in pink and, you know, he won't not stock that in his store. He knows if he has people who are that readership that he needs to buy that book. So for me, you know, I'm here kind of fighting the fight for the headless woman.
I guess that's a valuable insight, and as the conversation continues, we'll be able to draw on what it's like to be in those decision rooms when covers are chosen and that kind of thing. Leifa, what interests you about this issue?
For me, I am very involved and very invested in seeing women writers succeed and in seeing audiences that are looking for great stories, either by women or about women, find those stories. So this is an issue that particularly bothers me or certainly weighs on me because I think there are a lot of those examples, as Chrissy talked about, where there are so many books that are so heavily marketed to women that it is a signpost to men. This isn't relevant to you. And exactly as the Jonathan Safran Foer example shows, men write about domestic issues and the same signposts are not applied. Mm. And so to me that says, well, you know, if so many men are willing to read Jonathan Safran Foer, I don't think that's just because he's a man. I think it's because that cover doesn't automatically tell them this isn't for you. And so
I mean, my theory is it has a bird on it because Jonathan Franzen's a twitcher. If yeah. You, if it had been written by a man, my theory about that book is that it would be a pair of old hands on a kitchen table, because that's what that book is about. It's about old people retiring and yep. not knowing what to do with their yep. lives.
And I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that, you know, even if you have a book about a woman and you want to signpost that it's for women, I'm not really sure why you need to dismember that woman in order for her to be representative that maybe women would like to read this. Like, I don't go out and think, oh, you know what, I really like it when there's just a shoulder. Just a shoulder and a butterfly. That's what I'm, you know, but that's what you will find. And so for me, I think, and having a child as well, I do agree that it starts really young. I just kind of like to see us challenge that. I don't really, you know, my experience is not in making books. So for me, the questions are, why do we make books this way? Mm. I'm really interested in that.
Well, Mary, do you think that women won't read books if they're not signposted that way? Let me put it that way.
No, the opposite. Women are very accepting readers and we don't do this... we don't do it to keep men away, I suppose. I mean, it is just... signposting. It's just a way of, you know, saying to them, you're busy, you're in a shop, you know what you like, you liked reading this book, we're giving you something that's kind of similar and familiar. And by chopping off the head, you're not sitting there and going, I don't know, I don't like her makeup, or, you know, I don't like the look on her face, what's she thinking about? You're just seeing from the neck down and going, oh yeah, I like this
book.
I do
prefer it when they don't have heads. That's
much better. I'm kind of thinking that there are books that really do need to be marketed that way. Like, I think there are books that are going to that are clearly saying this book was written with a woman reader, with a woman reader in mind. But I think that the real problem is when a book is not that kind of readership, where a book is on the fence. If it's written, you know, if it's a literary book, for instance, and there's, you know, let's face it, that's hardly any of the market at all. Like, hardly anyone reads literary fiction anymore. It's a tiny, tiny section of the market. And it really is important to keep that stuff clear so that it is, whether it's by a male or by a female, it has an equal treatment. So, I mean, the Now Scarred book, does anyone know Carl Ove Nausgaard? I wish I'd had pictures of his book up there, but he's got a series of books which is called My Struggle, and they're just about him and his life, and it's a novelization of his life. So it's about him parenting and being a father and you know, being a husband and all that sort of stuff. But it has a really strong image of his bearded face looking handsome and intense on the cover. And if it had been, you know, he's basically just doing what a whole bunch of women have done up till now, which is to write about the domestic sphere and to write about what it's like to be that parent or to be that husband or wife, you know, in that sphere. And yet, as a man, he's kind of applauded as, it's really great that a man can kind of, you know, take up the domestic kind of drama and turn it into something amazing, when it's not actually any more amazing than what a woman would have turned it into. It's just a perception, and the perception, I think, starts at the marketing department.
Do you think that literary books by women are kind of put in the dress, if you like, in order to sell them to a non-literary audience? Is that all part of trying to make literary fiction more accessible? And probably, in that way, is it laudable.
Look, it does. And one of my dear friends, Ashley Hay, has written a book called The Railwayman's Wife. I don't know if anyone's read it, but it's got a very girly cover. It's got a woman looking very sad with her face down and a kind of a veil, and below that a bit of a landscape. It's a cover that and a gold sticker saying Women's Weekly Pick of the Month, which, you know, I would never have read that book if I wasn't a friend of Ashley's, because I was like, oh, I'm going to have to read this book. And it's actually really awesome. And I actually think that it's going to kind of be a bit surprising for the women, the historical romance readers who are going to pick that book up, because it's got history and it's got romance in it, but it's certainly not a historical romance, and it does turn that whole genre on its head and is very much more literary. So when I looked at that book, I was like, oh, I really hate the cover, but it sold so many more covers than books that are marketed to just a literary fiction audience. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and the jacket has actually helped it out. And I kind of think, oh, does that actually mean that, you know, that we should just kind of dress these literary books up in something that's going to be a bit more, you know, lolly-like for the reading public?
I don't agree. Do we feel that there is a particular gender that literary fiction is appealing to? I mean, I would have thought it was pretty, you know, cross-gendered in a way.
It's a cross-gender.
And the problem with marketing is that you can't market to everyone. You know, there wouldn't be the phrase target market if you were targeting everyone. That's not a target. That's everyone. So you've got to, you know, look at it and go, well, look, I can either target this at men or women. With literary, you have to go out there and you have to punch and say, this is literary, it's highbrow, you're putting a cover on it. We know what literary fiction looks like. It looks beautiful, but you can't just go through a bookshop, you know, looking for something that looks beautiful because you're going to like to read that. You need it to have had, you know, reviews and traction and get past the gatekeepers again.
The interesting thing in that example is, for sure, I'm positive that would have sold more and probably found more readers. What interests me is whether it would then have been nominated for awards, whether it would have been considered in that same, as you were talking about, canon of amazing literature that's based in history and maybe
and
has a romance in it.
It kind of got overlooked until it just recently won the big, I can't remember what it's called now, the Colin Roderick Award for Historical Research, and it beat Richard Flanagan. And, you know, it's kind of like, well, yes, it actually is amazingly researched and incredibly detailed and quite exquisite, but it did miss all of the Premier's Awards. It did miss the target. And I wouldn't be surprised, having been once on a panel of judges and kind of being faced with a mountain of books, you do kind of go, I'm going to really love these books that look like they're targeted to me, and I'm just going to go, these books are probably mainstream,
I'll flick them a bit,
popular fiction that are not going to be in the pile. It really is. It's a very tricky one, because it is certainly... It might miss the mark with sales, but it also, you know, do you want the sales or do you want those kind of prizes?
I mean, it comes back to, again, that, you know, getting past the gatekeepers and getting into the hands of the readers in that first iteration. I mean, it's very rare nowadays that you get a second bite at the apple, that you get to recover the book.
Yes.
So in that first print run, you've got to get the cover that is going to appeal to the most sellers and hopefully give you then an opportunity, you know, the sales enough to reprint, and then if you really feel it's warranted, recover. But it's a big commitment for a publisher to recover a book. I mean, I'm not quite sure why the example's up there, why they recovered that second cover of the three books that you put up with.
The Julia Swinson
House
one.
There
were different markets as well. So one of them was the English cover.
Right. There you go then.
And the Australian cover brought in the UK cover first and then...
And then did their own. But there you go. I mean, they needed to get enough traction and sales that would allow them the permission, the finances, to recover it and to try something different.
So I think we're back to... I think with the conversation... So far, we're back to the idea that it really starts with the kids section. Like, I actually think that what you're talking about is valid. Like, I think that there are going to be people who just want the big airport blockbuster, and we really can't put John Birmingham's next blockbuster novel in a dress. We can't do that because, although, you know, having just been to the Gautier exhibition, I would love to throw Femme. I would love to just chuck Femme at all those big kind of books with guns in them and, like, have the people's wielding guns and wearing like feathers. Like, I think that would be awesome. Yeah. But we can't quite, unless we're Gautier, we can't do that at the moment. I think we need to maybe go back to the children's section. I think that what we've got is the will you wrap this for a boy or will you wrap this for a girl issue. Just, it needs to start early.
So this is something I know, Leifer, you're really passionate about.
I am.
I thought you were joking when you said that boys don't read stories about girls.
It's true.
But you weren't joking.
Well, look, I'm not actually saying that they don't. I actually don't think that the kids are necessarily that discerning. It's their parents and the teachers that are that discerning.
And I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's something that we've said so often now that new parents don't even test the mantra. They're just so keen, and we're all keen to get our kids reading. You know, we know that it's important and that it starts very young. And so if you hear that being said, or you go into a bookstore and they say, and you say, oh, I'd like to, you know, a book for my niece or my nephew, maybe not even your own children, and they say to you, okay, well, here are the things that are popular for boys at age three. Here are the things that are popular. Right. And so it all starts to, you know, click into place. I had, was very determined about this with my son, that I would try to have as many books featuring female protagonists for him from a very young age. And then I got exhausted. And, you know, that I don't know that we've got that balance. We certainly would be a lot closer than most people who weren't thinking about it. But it's also, it is a monumental task. And when I walk into a bookstore, I can't do that by just looking at all of the books. I have to actually, okay, I'll pick it up and I'll read it and I'll see what I, you know, want to see. But I also have other criteria for books that I would like for him to enjoy. So it's very difficult to just say, even getting a female protagonist in a children's picture book for him is a hurdle. And if I'm conscious and I'm looking for that and I want that and I find it difficult, what is it like for, you know, other parents who just want a good book for their kid?
Yeah. And who might not buy a book very often for their child.
Absolutely.
And so
absolutely.
Then when you do, you want it to be a surefire winner.
Yep. Well, from a background of working in children's publishing, I mean, the big thing that we always stick to is that boys are reluctant readers. They would rather be outside playing with a ball. Getting them to sit down and read a book is a really tough thing. Parents, you know, struggle with this constantly. If we then package something for them that is going to have anything in there that might turn them off, you know, a kissing scene or something awful, and they should be, you know, running around cowboys and Indians instead, you may not get that kid to sit down and read another book. So, you know, even, you know, as a publisher, you're kind of constantly thinking, is it better that I'm giving them something that they will just read and that their parents can buy and sit them down in front of, so that when they then become an adult, they'll love reading and they won't, you know, resent it? No.
But I think this is part of the picture too about why do we want people to read altogether, and on what's important about
to
reading.
Sell books.
Absolutely, some of us would definitely go that way. Yeah. But we also have that point of view of you know, our books and our stories are a reflection of our world. And by the time you discount any boy reading a story about girls, why is it any surprise that they can't relate to or find interest in the women and the women's stories in their lives?
And surely that starts early. That ship is slowly turning, right? Like,
so.
Frozen is the, like,
oh my God, yes.
The story that will change that, maybe.
It's not necessarily changing, I don't think, because, you know, we do have the Stella Prize mob having to go into schools, and we do have schools where until, you know, grade 10 sometimes, there's no book on the curriculum that has a female protagonist until they get to, like, grade 10, 11 and 12, because they say we need to appeal to both boys and girls. Now, I think this is a problem because, you know, if you actually get an awesome book that has a female protagonist, a young boy will read that and go, that's cool. Like, that is really cool. There's, you know, there's nothing that says a book that has, you know, shooting in it doesn't have to have a girl protagonist. There's nothing that says that, except when you maybe pitch it to the publisher, when they kind of go, oh, we're going to lose half your market if you don't have, you know, a male protagonist. Now, I actually think that we need to actively, in a similar way to we have to have the Stella Prize, because we need to address an inequality that's happening in the award system. We need to address an inequality that's happening in the reading of young people and in the fact that boys are being marketed to in that way. Mm-hmm. And I also think that we're not addressing the fact that there's more and more online reading, and that's reading. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people, like boys and girls, are reading articles that they come across online in lots of different ways, and that those articles and ideas also can contain both women and men doing awesome things.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, gendered cover design is helping the rise of the ebook. I mean, we know the story of, you know, ebook sales skyrocketed when 50 Shades of Grey became a big thing because people wanted to read it and not have anyone know that they were reading it. So they would download it on their Kindle.
Yeah. So we just need to give, we kind of need to give permission to guys to also read books about women at an early age. And like we need to kind of, and to give that permission, we also need to provide them with really great examples of those books. And then maybe slowly we can kind of change it.
Yeah, I also think it's a huge disservice to say that all boys are reluctant readers. And I think, you know, it's something that we do talk about a lot, and I don't doubt that a lot of boys are reluctant readers. I think that that is, you know, the case for some boys. But I also think that that we, again, are setting that up as an expectation.
Yeah, because some girls are reluctant readers
as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so I think that, you know, again, all of these things that we start talking about with really young kids, we kind of need to break that down and say, sure, maybe they're reluctant readers, but all we need to focus on is giving them great stories. Mm. And there is nothing to say that those great stories can't have either gender in them. And I think, again, when you, you know, when you look at Suzanne Collins and her success, or you look at the fact that, you know, that there are, I guess, more heroines than ever, you know, it shows that you can do it when you're writing a great book. And so, again, I think even the fact that we think, well, I really want a boy who's a reluctant reader, why can't I write a book about a girl who kicks ass just as well as a boy who kicks ass? Like, that that should be just as easy and just as important.
And that non-fiction is equally as valid as fiction.
Yep.
And so a lot of boys do read a lot of non-fiction, maybe in sort of magazine-y short form often. Mm. And that those stories should equally be, like, non-fiction should equally be about women doing stuff too, and quite often it's not. Quite often it's
true. And also the idea that only books about romance are the only girl books too. You know, like there are lots of books about girls that are marketed as being about romance when actually they're really not like that at all.
That's true.
And I know a lot of boys who read Judy Blume, you know, covertly, and you know, they really appreciated those books. They're just as good for boys. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of hints there.
Yeah, a lot.
Mary, we're going to do we're going to nominate our worst offenders of the year for 2014 in a minute. But before that, just one final kind of insight from maybe children's perspective. Mm-hmm. How, when you had a book, how did you write the brief for the designer?
Oh, tough. Well, I mean, look, you'd start with, this is a book for.
Mm-hmm.
This is a book for girls or boys aged between this age and that. Mm. And then you'd kind of just...
we also hear a lot about ideas about what those marketing rules are. Like, oh, well, you can't have green on a cover. Is it green?
Yeah, you can't
have green. At the moment, green.
You can't. Yeah. Green books don't sell.
But where do these come from? Like, what is there, like, history. One huge failure that everyone goes,
the history of publishing.
I remember
everyone
the story
knows
of Kermit. It went just so badly. Like, what is that?
I've discovered that books with horses on the cover don't sell as well.
Oh, that's particularly bad for you.
People think that they're rural romances.
No.
So if you try and sell it, and that's as a bookseller, you try and sell, you know, Gillian Mears' fantastic False Bread to
so
someone
good.
And they go, I don't like books about horses. And you're like, no, it's not about horses. And they go, no, I don't like books about horses. So it's like, okay.
But there are people who solely read books about horses. Like, that's an industry.
That's true.
As well.
So, you can kind of get this niche market.
Yeah, I briefly worked at Penguin and we had a whole
horse section.
Yeah. and they're awesome. Like, I love rural romance, so...
Before we throw to the offenders, can I just also mention Justine, how do you say it, Labaluster? Is that her name?
Labaluster.
She wrote a book called Liar, and I thought it was really interesting because the marketing of her book called Liar had a white girl on the cover and the main character was a black girl.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The marketing department of that said, well, if we put a black girl on the cover, we're going to narrow our market. Mm. And again, it's, you know, it's like just, it's one, it's kind of all... there's a problem that's kind of across the board, and it's not necessarily about, like, I think the marketing departments are doing their job because they're going, we're not going to be able to sell that book with the black girl on the cover. And they're probably right. Mm. And I actually think that the problem is, I still think we've got to start with the kids, because the problem is growing readers who are accepting of characters that are, you know, female, male, black, white,
other.
Whatever, mm. other. And mm. I think that, yeah, so I don't think that we should be, you know, whipping the marketing departments at all, mm. or the designers, because they're actually doing their job and they're trying to sell those books. Yeah. Like you said, they are mm. selling to the right market. But I actually think that we need to kind of whip the general public into shape by kind of redressing that, as we're doing with the Stella Prize, which mm-hmm. is like getting the figures. We don't have any proper figures on this at all. This is all kind of hearsay. This is all from, you know, our own experiences.
Mm. Yeah,
we need to kind of get some detailed research into
coming back
stuff.
To Stella Prize again for a moment, and diversity in general, not just mm. you know, gender diversity. I ran a publishing conference last week, and the closing panel we talked a little bit about the future of publishing and the book, and John Page was on that panel again, the bookseller from Pages and Pages, and we talked about, you know, what is our role as a bookseller, as a publisher, as a marketer, in diversity in the industry. And I asked John, you know, do you have any sort of gender quota when you stock your bookstore? And he said no, but thankfully we've got things like the Stella Prize. And mm. he goes, and I will stock the whole shortlist. So mm. it's really doing such good for this
yeah,
industry.
It's working for those people.
Raising
who won't
awareness.
Read those
yeah,
books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And similarly, you know, having showing different genders and ethnicities on covers and within the pages is equally as important, and we kind of, you know, touch on those discussions.
Mm. Our alarm?
No.
Shall we go to the nominations?
So these are yours first.
Oh, mine. Good. Well, yeah, I was... This is not 2014. I didn't read the brief.
No, it's good. Sorry.
We went through a lot of 2014 covers in our discussions, and my problem is that I didn't really hate any of them. I think they all served a purpose. They signposted and they will sell a book properly. The only thing that I really, really loathe with book covers is the film tie-in. I think you actually didn't get the film tie-in up
here.
That's
my fault.
That is the one thing that will put me off buying a book ever, is if it, even if I wanted to read it, I will not buy the film buy-in tie-in cover. So for me, when I was looking through, so the other thing is I have to caveat this with, when I was looking for other examples, the worst examples I could find were all books that I'd made myself. And these guys were like, no, don't dub yourself in. It's okay. So I've done finance books dressed up as Chiclet.
Oh.
Like actually as Chiclet, like you read the book and the protagonist is like, I can't afford this and I've got to go on a financial diet, and
wow.
Sold really well. So
I mean, women's finance is, you know,
big
a hot
industry,
issue.
Yeah. Big industry, yeah. Yeah. So this is my, you know, I loved Hating Alice Nashley as a kid, and I'm sure a lot of people in the audience here read it as a school book as well. But the idea is that it had to get past the gatekeepers, you know, female protagonists being aimed at any primary school children, boys and girls. So the covers that it started with, which I think here, the orange one, the one with the orange around the outside, is probably the one a lot of us remember from, let's not show our age here. And then it's kind of, you know, as it has gained traction over the years, it got syllabized and it has been covered and turned into a play and eventually into a movie. That has allowed the publishers to start experimenting with the covers and going into more, you know, feminine realms. So, but if it hadn't had that kind of disengendered in cover initially, it would have never got the traction that that it needed to appeal
Lots
to both boys and girls.
Lots of green on that cover, I note.
But it's fluoro,
just
that's
quietly.
Okay. It was the 90s, it's okay. but yeah, the most vile one, which obviously is one that has sold really, really well, is the film tie-in cover. I encourage you all to go look it up. It's got Delta Goodrum on it and lots of pink sparkles and it's vile.
Lisa, Oh, well, whatever's next on the slides. Who's doing next?
Oh, is that you?
Is that it? Oh, no.
Oh, this is me. Right. So we've already talked about Alice Munro, which I forgot. However, I want you all to know that this book with the lady's legs has stories about such delightful topics as cholera, the death of an infant, and domestic abuse. It's just outrageous. You can't tell at all. And I would be really annoyed if I wanted a beach read and that's what I picked up.
Also, if you pick that up, yeah, and I would like to know if that was a summer holiday cover. Like, was it just like, oh, we'll just sneak it in?
It's got the Nobel Prize sticker.
I would dare say that the moment there was that Nobel Prize sticker to go on it, they've incorporated. You can't pull that off. I'm pretty sure. Not that one.
Yes.
A lot of those Women's Weekly ones, they have a special glue that goes on the stickers because
they're really hard to take off. So hard because it's death to a lot of our books when a book comes out with a Women's Weekly sticker on it. We're just like, oh no, it was a really good book and they've stuck the Women's Weekly sticker on it. A whole bunch of our readers are going to not take it.
Does the Oprah thing do the same thing?
The Oprah thing did do the same thing, but they're also, they use a special glue that's really difficult to take off. No eucalyptus oil is getting that sticker off.
What's next?
Oh, this one's mine because the jacket on the right-hand side was the initial jacket that I saw of this book, which was the American jacket. And I kind of said, oh, man, I really want to read that book. It's kind of, you know, the next best thing to a man on his own in the snow, really. It's kind of houses on their side with sort of dark clouds. And then it came in Australia and it got this kind of romantic, historical, woman taking the woman from behind kind of jacket. And I suddenly lost interest in the book and I haven't read it as a result. And I was so looking forward to it. When it came in the second jacket, I completely lost interest. So it was a really interesting kind of thing where even I, who know that the content is not the same as the jacket, I still really am put off by the look.
And our last one?
This is the one that we talked about a little bit earlier with Chrissy. And I chose this because I think it was just the one that made me most, like, enraged. What the hell? I really, you know, there are lots of reasons I hate that second cover. But I, you know, to me, that could be a cover for Lolita, you know? And so I'm confused. It's a male protagonist. It's a book that all kids equally love and read. And it is an absolute joy of a book. You've got Quentin Blake's amazing illustration and the classic edition. You choose this. And it genuinely does make me ask, what the fuck? I really do not understand it at all.
So we're going to take a vote from the audience about which is the worst one. So we have Hating Alice and Ashley, Alice Munro, We Are Not Ourselves, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So I don't know how we're going to do that.
Let's just clap it out.
It out. Yeah. Okay, so Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh!
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one, so...
I think it probably does,
I think we all take it personally, though. Like, how many of us didn't love it as a kid?
Yeah, I'm going to give up after that, actually.
Although I do actually like the cover. It's weird and it's odd and it looks a little bit like everyone's been taken over by aliens. I kind of like the jacket, but... possibly not for that book.
Yeah.
But also we need to get going on questions from the audience. So get your questions in your brains. We've got our great people with the mics coming
also,
through.
Also, someone's
now.
Husband did dob them in as being a book designer. We do have a book designer.
I didn't want to pick on her.
No.
She knows all the answers. So. She doesn't have any questions. All right, come on. Don't let me shame you into it. Here we go. Here's one.
With that genderisation.
Just wait for the mic. Thanks.
With that genderisation of book covers, does that come with the contemporary young women's discomfort with feminism?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think based on the depth of the amount of books that's happening for, I think that that's probably not the case. And I think even, for example, something like Anita Hess's Titters, for example, which is actually a beautiful cover, sort of purple flowers cascading, and it's really gorgeous. And I think there has been quite a lot of feminists who've championed that book, again, because it is a contemporary urban story about Indigenous Australian women, and a lot of feminists like it because it is a story about women friendship as well. And yet I don't think that they would have been put off or that their ideas would have changed if the cover were less feminine. I think the idea of feminism as it relates to book covers in terms of... I think if you have a look at some of the ones that we have there that make up the overall cover girl and some of the pink ones, Roxane Gay's book... Bad Feminist has bright pink on it, as do a lot of others... Female Chauvinist Pigs by Ariel Levy and things like that.
Lena Dunham's recent memoir.
So I think it's interesting that in some ways they do, again, it's the signposting thing, but I think
Dress Memory by Lorelei Bastion. Fantastic jacket, great book.
Very pink. That it's her.
Very pink.
Yeah. I think your question implies that individuals have more awareness of power structures than they do. Like, we are told that is what girls like from such an age. That's what we've been talking about. So I don't think it's about individual women saying, I specifically reject this kind of book and I specifically embrace this version of femininity. It's just the way, it's in the water. That's how we think.
And I think it shows that it's just almost that it's gone too far. Like, when you have an Isabel Allende cover, which has a white girl on it, and has been pinkified, you know, when you look at it, you just think, where is that? Like, why did it need to be applied to this? It doesn't suit, it doesn't
fit. But also remember that it's not just the women the women are actually the ones who are accepting. So the young feminist, the non-feminist women are kind of accepting of all jackets. So the trend is that it's the boys that are excluded from the jackets that are feminised, not the women. So the young women who say, you know, I support women's rights but I'm not a feminist, are equally going to read the grey Booker Prize winner as they're going to read the pink book as well, you know. Well, whereas it's the boys that won't.
Amount out about women by reading books.
Yeah.
and it's, I think, the Alison Ashley effect.
I think teenage boys too. Like, if we could somehow market to teenage boys that you could actually, if you're heterosexual, you can get that chick by reading that book.
It's the trope of every dance film ever. Learn how to dance, get the girl. Come on, guys.
Learn how to read books about women and suddenly you understand how you can date them. That might actually work.
That's a good point. But also for those younger kids as well, you know, my four-year-old, I don't think he's particularly crazy. He has an absolute adoration for the BFG and Sophie, and he's really upset that he won't grow up to be a sister, not have a sister, be a sister, because of Frozen. And so I think, you know, again, I think we all do all of this excluding really young. That means that we don't get to see those parts of particularly young
and
boys.
And the Oliver Jeffers crayon book.
Yes.
I've got a friend who's six, like this little boy who's six, and he started using pink crayons because apparently in the crayon book, The Crayon Revolution by Oliver Jeffers, the pink crayon doesn't get used by the boy and is really, really sad. And so he started drawing everything in pink because he wanted pink crayon. He wanted to make him happy again. It's really cute.
All right, we've got another question.
Hi, ladies. Thanks for tonight. It's been awesome. Still awesome. I was wondering...
Is that our wrap-up?
We're done.
Thanks, guys.
I guess it's probably mostly for Mary. Do you have any advice for people in the industry or particularly writers when they're negotiating their book covers? I know I have a friend who's about to publish a book. Her first book's coming out. It's non-fiction. It's about sexual culture of Gen Y, and she was petrified about what her cover is going to be. Now, you know, thankfully she likes it, but that's because she's good at negotiating. Do you have any tips from a publisher's point of view?
Trust your publisher. They know what they're doing.
That didn't go down well.
Overall, they've been doing this for a while. They're professionals. They're backing your book by publishing it. They're going to do what their, you know, expertise tells them is the best thing to do for that book. If you are lucky enough is the wrong phrase. If you're lucky enough to have negotiated some sort of rights to, you know, a say in your cover, still listen to your publisher. You know how to write, and that's great, and you might have really firm views on what you want to see, and a publisher's going to listen to you. A good publisher will listen to you, but ultimately, they're working with the booksellers. If you really hate what a publisher comes up with for your cover, challenge them to talk to a bookseller. Yeah. And most good publishers will go to their trusted bookseller and they'll say, look, here's the cover that we've designed. What do you think? Is this going to hit the market? And booksellers have very firm views. Mm. So, sorry, I hope that hasn't really been very helpful, has it?
One more question over here. We'll probably only have time for one more.
Hi, guys. How powerful do you think book covers are in terms of shifting thought processes? As in, if men start seeing book covers that portray women as, you know, fanciful and pink and sparkly and weak and flimsy, do you think that that's just going to be another societal thing that teaches men that, you know, to think certain ways about women?
Is there
just another arm of the patriarchy, I suppose?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I think it's just, it is another, it's like opening a magazine and kind of being, you know, bludgeoned over the head by, you know, some skinny, you know, perfect, you know, example, big-titted girl. You know, it's the same thing when you open the box of books and there are all the girls on the books. But sometimes, but often the publishers get it right. You know, often the publishers get, you know, like Fable Parrott's first book, Past the Shallows. We opened the box for that book and went, oh my God, that's going to sell. The moment we opened that book and there was this beautiful kind of seahorse on the front and this gorgeous kind of ocean picture, and we went, oh, that's a beautiful jacket, that's going to sell to everybody. So quite often they get it right. And again, quite often, like if that book comes out and it's sparkly pink, you know, we won't read it because it's going to be only for a particular area of the market, and that's, you know, young women of a particular type.
And it's worth
often
noting,
it's supposed to be for that group.
That's right. I was going to say, your bookshop is more literary than many bookshops. Yeah,
so we've got a very different market to, you know, like when you walk into a book world or something where you kind of, there aren't any book worlds, but, you know, where we walk into a mainstream bookshop and you see like bunches of bestsellers, we've got a very different kind of clientele. So it's really obvious to us when a book is not going to sell to our clientele. Mm-hmm. And that's often when it is very, very heavily gendered.
Mm-hmm. We should not scapegoat the book. There are other forms of media that are putting sexism out there as well.
Yeah, that's right. Like, magazines are the, you know,
magazines,
prime suspect. Yeah,
movies, everything. Movies. So,
I think it's another brick in the wall. I think it's part of an overall culture that does this. And I do think that we should be critical of it, not to say that it is more or less responsible than any of those other forms, but I do think that my question is, again, it's not just the feminisation, like this is pink, this is girly, this is for you. I don't think that message is always bad, but I think that we're now piling every book written by a woman into that category, and that I have a serious problem with. And I think
when
that
those
does
might not identify with
yes,
that.
Absolutely.
Again, we have the whole quote about the Rottweiler in a dress.
Yes.
If you've got a Rottweiler, don't put it in a dress.
Yes.
And if it's a Rottweiler written by a woman, don't stick it in a dress.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Okay, one last question because we're well over time, I think. But in the back left corner there.
Hi, I guess I just wanted to ask, do you see this more as a contemporary sort of issue, and do you see gender typing getting more and more common or sort of staying the same or getting less?
We've got more books.
Yeah.
We've got more books out there, so yeah, so there's more to...
And more books by women.
And more books by women, yeah, where it used to be kind of like the, you know, the walls around the great male authors. Now we're kind of breaking all that down. So yeah, it is more prominent now, and that's why we have to kind of kick it in the guts now. Because now is when we're getting women, but we're getting Aboriginal women writing, we're getting Aboriginal men writing, we're getting, you know, people with disabilities writing, and we need to kind of stop marginalising it into, you know, only people with a disability can write this, can read this book by a person with a disability. That's not true. You know, we need to extend readership across the broad spectrum.
And I think I definitely think the problem is becoming more apparent, and it's definitely happening more. But I think what's interesting is that we now take these covers of classics, even those written by men, and we, if they have a woman in them, or the audience for that book is perceived to be a woman, we do the same thing to that book retrospectively. Madame Flaubert, I think, was the one that I noticed the most, where it's gone from quite a classic picture of you know, quite a romantic painting being the picture for that book, and now it's all lips and hips again. And so that, to me, is definitely a sign that we are doing it more frequently, but we're also, you know, placing it back on those books that didn't have those covers in the first place.
I think that actually picks up the fact that, that yes, there might be some sort of, you know, wave happening at the moment, but if it's something like a classic that's experimenting with this kind of stuff, don't worry. It's going to, you know, it's going to come good. Yeah, it's going to come good. Classic. It's opening up the classics market to the female readers. You know, we're kind of going, well, look, we kind of know how to market to these people now, and we know how to get them reading, so let's get them going back to the classics and experiencing some really, you know, stuff that has been cross-gendered for years. So it's not always a bad thing.
Although it does exclude people. Let the new books from winning the prizes, getting the reviews, being read by the male readers, and I think that's where we need to kind of focus.
Yeah.
Well, that seems like an excellent place to finish up. Thank you, Chrissy Neen, Lisa Singleton-Norton and Mary Nelson.